Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, some trend forecasters are saying that we're heading back to comfort food. And if that's true, there isn't any food more comforting than aromatic, warm, fresh bread, and for my taste, with a great crust. Just saying those words creates an image, a memory, a flavor of good times, and usually accompanied, in my case, with olive oil or sometimes butter, and great food, and maybe a glass of wine. Well, if you love bread, you'll envy today's guest because she lives the life of bread. Avery Ruzica is with us today from Manresa Restaurant in Los Gatos. Manresa Bakery.
Bread.
Yeah. Well, Manresa Bread. Well, Avery, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's jump in here because you have a career in bread. And like I said, there's a lot of people that or would be very, very jealous because there are a few things that they love more than bread. So, first of all, how did you find yourself in this career of bread?
So I definitely didn't set out to be in this career. I definitely wasn't anticipating in this career. 10 plus years ago, I was on the track, I thought, to become perhaps a writer, and I thought I wanted to be a food writer, and thought it would be a good idea to spend a little bit of time in a restaurant kitchen before I set out into the world as a writer or tried my hand at it. And when I spent a summer right before finishing college working in a kitchen in North Carolina, where I'm from, I fell in love with the kitchen, the life of a cook. I was smitten. I was obsessed. I couldn't get enough of it. And so I finished college and I decided to enroll in a culinary program in New York at the French Culinary Institute. And I moved up to New York. And the program that I was enrolled in is a 6-month program. I wanted something that would allow me to kind of get a little bit stronger of a foundation before I looked for a job. And was really happy with the program, but they also in the same school offered a bread program. And I just found myself really drawn to it. Just the smells, the sounds, it's just the one of my classes in the culinary program, the classroom for the bread program was directly across the hall. And all the classrooms had big glass windows. And so you could be in one class and watch them making the bread. And I thought, I just really want to do that. And so the timing worked out perfectly. I finished the culinary program after 6 months. And I went ahead and enrolled in the bread program, which was a short program. And I just, everything about it just clicked. It felt so right. And so I did that program and followed that up with a 3-month internship at Per Se and Bouchon in New York City in their bread program. And, you know, definitely knew that the life of a baker was a great fit for me at that time. I had not been ready to commit to giving up on my dream of being a cook yet. So after I finished that internship, I went ahead and looked for another job as a cook. And worked as a cook in New York for another 6 to 8 months. And that's when David Kinch kind of came back into the picture. I'd met him once in culinary school.
So at that stage, I mean, you're starting to be drawn towards being a baker, mm-hmm. who you refer to as a baker. And then you met David Kinch. Now there's a few people maybe that haven't heard of David Kinch, sure. But he's actually one of the most highly regarded chefs in the entire world. I think if people put a short list together and said, who are the best chefs in the world? David Kinch is, I think, always on those lists. And he has in Los Gatos, California, a restaurant that's a 3-star restaurant, which for those that don't keep track of their star numbers, that's about as good as you can get. And it is always ranked as one of certainly the best in America. And like I say, I think one of the best in the world. And like all good restaurants, they have bread.
I actually had met David I met him my first maybe week or two of culinary school, and that had been, I really didn't know much about Manresa at that point. It was in California. I was from North Carolina. Most of my knowledge of fine dining restaurants was actually more in Europe than it was in the United States. And so I met David, and what really drew me to Manresa was watching him work along with one of his sous chefs. They were using my classroom kitchen to prepare for an event they were in New York to take part in. And both he and his sous chef were really focused, but also really relaxed. There was kind of this effortless energy to them, but in the most kind of engaging way, you know. So they knew what they were doing. They were, you know, they were having fun while they were doing it. They were roasting little wild strawberries and, you know, looking at the strawberries and kind of both taking so much joy in how beautiful these tiny little strawberries were. And then they were going back to work quietly, silently. And it just was really engaging. And it was the curiosity and the focus that really are what ultimately made me want to work at Manresa. A friend of mine got in touch and said that Manresa was hiring for a food runner, which is the person who literally takes the plates from the kitchen to the diners. And so I couldn't really afford to work for free anymore, which is very typical and something I'd done a lot of in New York. But I could be a food runner, I thought. So I flew out to California and I interviewed at Manresa for the food runner position and I got the job. And then I used my mornings because I had them free. I said, would it be all right if I helped you guys with your bread program? And so they gave me an opportunity to try that out and to prove that I knew a little bit about bread, that I wasn't, you know, I was going to hopefully make things better, not worse. And that's how I ended up at Manresa. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. And now we're going to kind of move forward into the bread itself now too, because I guess, I mean, you started working in bread at Manresa and then, but the several things in addition to making outstanding bread products there at Manresa, and I've eaten there a few times. It's really wonderful. But then you took the unusual step of going to farmers markets. And then at farmers markets, you had a couple farmers markets. I mean, I don't know of anybody that there's probably someone else, but I don't know of anybody that started like a 3-star world-class restaurant and then go to farmers markets. You hear people dreaming of going the other way around, but your journey with this product is making good product at this great restaurant and then doing the farmers market and then having a shop near the restaurant in Los Gatos, California. And then now you're actually looking at being able distributing the product, you know, throughout the country. This is kind of an incredible journey. Could you talk a little bit about that, about deciding that you could take the bread that you were having and then have it at farmers markets? Why does that make any sense to a 3-star restaurant?
I mean, I really think it has to do about getting back to kind of David's passion and curiosity, and that being the reason that I wanted to work there. So I was incredibly passionate and still am about bread and incredibly curious about bread. And when you're making, Manresa is not a very large restaurant. We're open 5 days a week. We do really, you know, one service per night. So you might have anywhere from 40 to 70 guests. So there's a limit on how much bread you are going to make. And I quickly hit that limit in the sense that I was making 5 different kinds of bread for service every day, plus crackers, plus a brioche for guests to take home. So, you know, I was making 7 or 8 different products, which was wonderful, but I was looking for another challenge. I wanted to make more bread, you know, and we had a customer, a diner come in, and he was one of the gentlemen who runs one of the farmers markets in the area. And he mentioned that they had a bakery that was going to be leaving the market, so they would have an opening for a bakery. And it is actually very difficult to get into farmers markets because they like to kind of limit how much competition between vendors there is, which makes sense. And so he proposed, what if I were to start selling our bread at the farmers market? And at this point, it was just me as a, you know, it's just the only baker. They'd never had a baker officially before anyway. And so I said, yes, let's try to do this. And everyone was on board. David was on board. Our chef de cuisine was on board. And so that's how it started. So it really, again, was about being excited about the product and wanting to learn more. And, you know, you can learn so much when you're making 70 pieces of bread a night, but when you start to make 150 loaves of bread or different sizes of breads, or, you know, and how to balance the fermentation in limited space, things like that, it was a challenge, and that's what I was looking for. And so I think that though it does seem a little counterintuitive that we went from the 3 Michelin star to the farmers market, the ethos that we were doing all of this with was the same, you know, the passion and the dedication to the highest quality product, to the best technique, to every weekend trying to make a better product, you know. So,
well, let's talk about that part of it then a little bit. You're saying about making the best product, mm-hmm. but that also must include having the best ingredients. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how you select the grains that you're using that are milled into flours. I
mean, we pay a lot of attention to that. And now that we have our own bakery, our own space completely, that's opened up the opportunities for us in a lot of ways, because access to ingredients can be somewhat limited depending on where you live, what part of the country you live in. And so things like our whole grains that we get in as a wheat berry, a rye berry, a spelt berry, those things are big and cumbersome. You know, they come in 50-pound bags typically. They're hard to buy depending on where you're trying to buy them from. A lot of the smaller farmers, which is who we purchase things from, they don't have a distribution contract with someone else. And so we buy directly from farmers for the majority.
So somebody contacts a farmer, say, in what, like Oregon or?
Oregon or Washington. Yeah. California too. So when I buy any of my grains, I buy them by the pallet. So I usually buy about, like, I just had 5 pallets of grain delivered, because we have to set up shipping directly through them.
How many pounds are in a pallet?
One pallet is 2,500 pounds. Yeah.
So somebody bought it from the farmer, and there's some. Oh.
No, in this case, no. I buy it directly from the farmer.
You buy it directly.
Yes, that's what it means when he doesn't have the farmers don't have a distribution agent. So in order for me to get their grain, I have to buy it directly from them.
How many of the farmers have you actually been to their farm?
Up north, I've only been to one of the farms. I mean, I've been to some of the farms around here, but I don't get as much around where we live in California. But we get more of our grain from up north, just because the climate is a little bit more conducive to a consistent product in terms of grain. It's a little, there are California grains to be purchased, but the quantity of them is a little more limited. So depending on, you know, consistency is such a huge part of the baking of any bakery. That's what we're striving for on a daily basis. And so having a consistent grain that is an organic grain, that weather plays a big part in that, you know, because so a place like Washington State or Oregon has a climate that's a little bit that aids in a little bit easier farming technique.
Well, there's a traditional wheat growing wheat belt is sort of the high plains, the Dakotas, Kansas, parts of Nebraska, I think. Have you sourced any from those areas?
I don't right now. I do get we get our white flour, which is a organic roller milled flour from a company called Camas Country, and they're a co-op that's based out of Utah, and they actually purchase their grain directly from various farmers that are parts of the co-op and then mill it in Utah. And so it's possible that I'm getting a little bit of grain from some of those wheat belt states, but a lot of it is directly actually from Utah too.
Now, when I think about getting grains, I think of certainly wheat, and there's several different varieties of wheat. You hear spelt, and I really don't know some of the other things that might be considered ancient grains. I mean, yeah. Rye. I mean, what are the grains you getting right now to make breads? And are there any grains that are kind of on your wish list? You're kind of looking down the road to grains you want to experiment with.
We currently use a lot of different varieties of wheat. So, you know, we talk about, I think most consumers, diners think about wheat, and they just think about wheat versus rye. But there are so many different varietals of wheat. And that's one of the big things that we do is we are really selective about what wheat variety we're using and what we use that wheat variety for. So we use a hard red spring wheat. We use a winter white wheat. We use a a wheat called Skagit that was developed by a farmer, and the Bread Lab, which is a kind of a, it's a satellite campus of Washington State University, and they are working on making a perennial wheat. So this is not that this is that, but this is another variety that they've found that like grows really well, has high protein contents, a lot of the things that we look for in our wheats. Then we use something called Einkorn. That's an ancient wheat variety. It has a lower protein content, but it has a really great flavor. So, you know, we're really thinking of wheat as a ingredient in the sense of, I mean, it's a plant like anything else. So it's like, and a certain kind of apricot is going to be better for jam. Another one's going to be better for baking. The same is true for wheat. A certain kind of wheat is going to be better for a large hearth loaf. Another one might be better for a pastry. And, you know, that's kind of part of the process of us developing our products that we sell.
I'm going to make listeners jealous here because you brought a couple of great loaves. And one of a baguette that we broke open and I've been having some. It's a wonderful, wonderful, delicious, nice crust. It's just beautiful, too. What kind of wheat was in that?
So that actually is, our baguettes have a bit of winter white wheat that we mill ourselves, and then they are organic white flour that is going to also be more of like a hard red spring wheat. But it's, when we talk about white flour, what that means is not that anything's been bleached, but it's just the center of the wheat berry. It's the endosperm of the wheat berry. And so that's what that guy is going to be. It's our starter that we make out of our whole wheat that we mill. And then it's typically just our organic white flour.
And then what's the other one that you brought?
The other one is it's made out of three varieties of wheat. It is made with Edison, which is a white wheat. And that just means that the grain itself, like when you mill the grain, it comes out a much paler color. Then we have a hard red spring. Hard red spring typically has the highest protein content. That helps give it structure. And then this also does have a little bit of the einkorn flour that we like, and that gives it a nutty flavor.
Just so delicious. The processing, the milling of it, because obviously, it seems like bread is being criticized by somebody. It goes through stages of, concerns about carbohydrates and now there's been, gluten concerns and so forth. And it just goes in waves that people like me that love bread, every once in a while, somebody's making you feel guilty that you shouldn't be eating bread or not eating as much. But there's something you do in the options and the milling process. Could you explain the whole difference of like whole grain and what that means, or the different choices you can make in how how the grains are milled into flour?
Sure. So there's multiple ways to mill flour. There's a roller mill. There's a grist mill. A grist mill is a stone mill. That's what we actually have in our bakery. Roller mills, there are miniature roller mills, but they're I think very few bakeries have their own roller mills. That's a little bit more on the industrial level. And beautiful flours can come from roller mills. But that's how we get like our white flour, is through a roller mill. And that's, if you kind of think of like almost like a steam roller, it's really just, it's this, the pressure is peeling the exterior of the berry, of the wheat berry off, and then giving you that little endosperm, which is then being kind of pulverized into white flour. And that's where we get our white flour. So it's not a chemical process. It's just literally about pressure. The grist mill, which is our stone mill, and that's typically what you're going to find in most bakeries that are milling themselves, that actually is literally two big millstones that are grinding the flour, grinding the berry. And so when it grinds the berry, depending on how tightly the two millstones are dialed in, you get a coarser or a finer flour. And so if we say something is whole grain, that means that after the flour has passed through the millstone, whether it's done so with the stones tight together or far apart, everything that's been ground down is still combined, and that's whole grain. And that means that endosperm that's in there, the wheat germ, the bran, all the different, so those are the three major parts of a wheat berry or any berry. Those are all combined still, which means that you've got the nutrients still totally in the flour, and that's whole grain. And so that's one of those big things that I think can sometimes get missed. Things can be kind of misnomered in the sense when we talk about something being just like a wheat bread, a whole wheat bread, or a whole grain bread, because what you want to really be looking for if you're concerned about the nutritional content is going to be a whole grain, which means that all the parts of the grain are still in the flour.
Well, just to clarify, though, that if it is whole grain, is it always brown?
Yes, it would, or depending on the color of the flour, it's going to be a richer, darker color. I mean, it depends on if I used a white wheat, a Edison, like a white winter wheat, that it's going to be very pale compared to like a red wheat, but it is still going to be a slightly darker color. And that's because that bran, especially, like kind of, those are the little flakes that you see in the grain. Then you can sift the flour. And when you sift the flour, you're typically sifting out the bran and potentially some of the germ. You're going to end up with a lighter colored flour.
But on the other hand, you can buy brown bread that's identified as whole wheat. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily whole grain. Is that right?
That's right. And that's where you're just going to kind of want to be reading the label or talking to the baker about, you know, I don't think that there are the tightest restrictions, especially on the bakery level, of how people kind of label things. You know, your local bakery might be calling something whole wheat, but they might be buying a sifted flour. So it might be made with all wheat flour, but it's not whole grain. It's all wheat. It's all wheat flour, but some of the bran or some of the germ might have been sifted out.
So I imagine a lot of people are like I've been in the past, and you go to a grocery store and you're picking up a packaged national brand or something like that, a regional brand, and you think that, well, I should eat the whole wheat, even though I think the white tastes better to me, but you're thinking you're getting more nutrition. You aren't necessarily.
You aren't necessarily. The thing I would look for if you're buying a loaf of bread that's prepackaged with, you know, all of the nutritional values on the back is how much fiber is in there, because that's going to be a reflection of like the bran. Also the vitamin content, because that, depending on if they say that they have added anything to it, because sometimes that's something that happens like with white bread, they kind of add back in various vitamins, like because where the vitamin is in the germ. If you think about a wheat berry, it's a seed basically, and the endosperm is sort of the center of the thing, and the germ is like the little rocket pack of fuel. And so when we mill our flour and then we take away that wheat, that germ was where all of those nutrients were. And so, because that was what was going to feed the little seed when it was in the ground for it to grow. And so when we take that away, we're taking away a lot of where the nutrients are.
So I've read before that back almost 100 years ago, when we started mass producing bread, the big discovery was that a large company could actually come up with, basically they took everything out. I mean, they created this bread that everybody said, isn't this wonderful? And I think that's when the term came to, the best thing since sliced bread. And it would just seem like, my goodness, that's wonderful. But in hindsight, what they were doing for mass production at the time was taking out a lot of the great nutrition. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of taking out a lot of the great nutrition, and because also with the availability of commercial yeast and kind of large scale production techniques. Not only were they suddenly using a flour that was lower in nutritional content, but then they were also taking away the slow fermentation that sourdough requires. So when we ferment our doughs, that is actually helping digest the gluten and some of the proteins in the bread, which helps allow our bodies to actually access like the nutrients that are in there, and also makes things a little bit more easy for us to digest. So it's kind of, so, you know, there are certain foods that if they're not fermented slightly, our bodies can't necessarily absorb all of the vitamins that are in there. And with bread, it's kind of the same thing. I find this to be true for myself too. If I don't eat a sourdough bread, if I eat just a store-bought white bread, it might taste okay, but I personally don't feel like I feel that great afterwards. That's when I feel like a little sluggish or a little, and it's because the sourdough has actually done some of the work for your body. Your body doesn't have to work so hard to digest sourdough breads. The fermentation has started, is already activated. And so when we commercialized bread making and we started to use commercial yeast that's much more fast acting, we sped up the whole process.
So that's interesting, because I've heard other people before that were like marketing kombucha, talking about how, try to make choices that there is some fermentation that's taken place.
Yeah.
And even sourdough bread. And you kind of scratch your head and said, oh yeah, you're kidding me. But the sourdough bread's not necessarily whole grain, but that's another thing though, most people don't realize that it's got some fermentation going for it.
Oh yeah, no, that's what sourdough definitely has going for it. I mean, that's where all the flavor comes from, and that's also where all the kind of goodness for you comes from. I mean, that's why people who do talk about being kind of gluten intolerant or sensitive typically do better if they try to eat a sourdough bread, because some of the gluten has already been broken down. I mean, that's part of the fermentation process. We, as bakers, we work hard to create gluten in order for there to be enough gluten to hold the bread together during the fermentation process and the baking. But it is kind of breaking down at the same time. And so now you go to eat this bread and you actually have a product that's already sort of partially, not to sound, I mean, odd, but it is partially kind of digested for you into a certain extent.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard that before, like even that, you know, gluten having a positive role to play. Now, let's talk about the bread. We've talked about the wheat, the grains that you're getting in, and they talk about the milling and how that can leave nutrition in. But the other ingredients I think of, and I tell me what I'm missing, but water and yeast and maybe some salt or something. But what else do you put in bread?
That's it. So typically, I mean, all of our breads, you could put, I mean, the sky is the limit in terms of what you could put in your bread. But like at Manresa Bread, all of our breads are sourdoughs. So they are flour, you know, and in our case, it's organic fresh milled flour, or the large majority of it is fresh milled. And then it could be a variety of different flours, so wheat or rye, water, a sourdough starter. So that's the yeast portion, but we don't use a commercial yeast. We use a sourdough culture that we maintain and feed on a daily basis, multiple times per day.
You feed it.
So you feed it flour and it eats flour. That's because, you feed it flour and then the yeast eats basically the sugars in the flour. And that's the fermentation process. And that's what gives life to your bread.
You know, I find fascinating is that there aren't so many different ingredients that you're working with, and yet there is a world of difference in how the breads taste.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, it's kind of like thinking how, somebody might try to, wine, or somebody might try to sing and they don't sound like Barbara Streisand, you know, there's different voices and they're all singing the same notes.
Definitely.
And yet with breads like that, you're working with the same basic ingredients oftentimes, but what makes the difference in the flavor? Why is some that's got exactly the same ingredients taste wonderful and some that's just like average?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the artistry of bread making right there. I mean, that's what makes people who love making bread fall in love with it, because the nuance and the kind of the craft of it is endlessly engaging. So it has to do with ratios first and foremost. So the ratio of all ingredients to flour. So that's the way that we as bakers discuss what goes into bread. Everything is in proportion to the flour, and that allows us kind of to discuss and anticipate what our bread might be like. Then the other variables that are included are time. So the length of time that you plan to kind of give life or fermentation, like allow the bread to ferment before you bake, that's going to change huge amounts of things in the bread. And then temperature, and that's the temperature at which you ferment things. And then the last is the skill of the baker. So you work to, you know, make decisions about all of those steps and processes, but then at the end of the day, the baker has to also shape things that can affect things like the texture of the dough, which can also affect the mouth feel, and then how you bake something in the end too. Do you bake it?
Avery, I want to kind of wrap up now about something that's a new wave for you, because you've had such a wonderful journey. I mean, you've fell in love with bread. You find yourself out here. You've gone from a 3-star Michelin star restaurant doing breads to a bakery to farmers markets. And you're making this wonderful, wonderful bread. But there's got to be people who are listening to this saying they're hating the fact that they don't happen to live close by to come to the farmer's market or to come to your shop. But you're doing another thing that's unprecedented. Why don't you explain this new venture that you're growing into?
Yeah, so we are just about to launch national shipping for our sourdough breads. So we will be shipping our breads anywhere in the lower 48. We'll be shipping in groups of 4 loaves. So it can be, it's the customer's choice. Though we also offer recommendations, and we're shipping our sourdough breads nationally. So with each shipment comes a little pamphlet about how to enjoy our breads, because the bread will be, you know, it'll be a day and a half or 2 days out from the time it was baked. But that is the beauty of a sourdough bread, especially highly hydrated sourdough bread made with fresh flours, because the shelf life of them is impressive. And so we provide to the customer a little kind of guide about how to best enjoy the bread, so that it really is almost as if you just baked it yourself.
So are they going to warm it up when they get it?
I recommend, depending on how you're choosing to enjoy it. But I think that if you are planning to just, you know, get that delivery and decide to have a loaf with dinner that night, I recommend warming, if you know, half a loaf or a full loaf of bread in the oven for about, it's like 10 minutes at 350. You know, just want to warm it through. The crust will come right back, and there's so much moisture in the bread itself that the crumb will be very moist and very tender.
Avery, I don't know if you ever get tired of these paradoxes, because again, this is kind of like another one in a way. I mean, you really represent the craft, artisan bakery and what you're doing, but then national distribution. I mean, a lot of people think what goes hand in hand is that it's local, organic, it's local, it's, you know, but it's local supplied, and you're able to take local, national. How do you get your head around that? Yeah. That's such a different concept.
Well, I, you know, the thing that made me love food was that I got to, or cooking, was that I got to do this thing that in some ways felt incredibly kind of selfish, because I loved cooking so much. It felt sort of hedonistic and almost a little like self-involved in the best possible way, because it was just so mentally and creatively engaging. But then at the end of the day, you work hard in a kitchen to make something that you've enjoyed so much, taken so much pleasure in making, and you get to share it with a guest. And that felt so great, because it was like, I get to do something I love to do, and then I get to share with people. And that's kind of always been my mentality in the kitchen. When it comes to bread too, now we offer our bread sliced. A lot of bakeries that make artisan style breads don't offer it sliced because it is a little difficult to slice, because it is very moist and wet, and you know, it's just, but it was like, if people want their bread sliced, we should offer it to them sliced. And I feel the same way about shipping nationally. Yes, it is true that if you live in our neighborhood and you're able to come get the bread locally, that's the very best option. But there are so many people who enjoy and value and desire great bread, and it will take a day or two to get to you. That is true. But when it gets to you, it's still going to be wonderful. And if you warm it in the oven, it's going to be, you know, 10 times better than anything that you might even have remotely close to you. So it's like, the point of it is that people are excited to enjoy the bread, and we're excited to bake it. And it seems like then we should be able to do those things.
Well, I think you should be able to too. And if people listening today would like to see more information about the bakery and keep track of this new project, so in case they want to try your bread, where do they look?
They're going to just want to look on our website, which is manresabread.com. And all of the information about how to order the bread, you know, how to enjoy the bread, where to find the bread, that's all going to be available there.
Well, Avery Ruzicka, thank you very much for being on Farm to Table Talk today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.